Good afternoon. Our next presenter is Dana Ashford Kornberger, and she is with the NRCS, and her presentation is on developing nutrient management plans and NRCS reviewer's perspective.
Thank you, thank you. I always apologize. My name is quite the handful. So I am Dana Ashford Kornberger. I am the National Nutrient Management Specialist with NRCS. I work in our Ecological Sciences Division at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. And my presentation today is going to be right in line with what Luther spoke about at the beginning of this session, the ICCA Nutrient Management Planner specialty. So you'll see a lot of similarities between the 590 Nutrient Management Plan standard from NRCS and the performance objectives for that specialty. So hopefully that will be helpful for those of you that are thinking about doing that specialty or people that are doing that specialty, giving you some of your continuing education credits. So I'm going to start off the presentation talking a little bit about our practice standard, the Conservation Practice Standard 590. Then I'm going to go into the basics of a plan that meets that standard. And then at the end, I'm going to talk about a few, I call them things to watch, issues that we see, things that when our own employees are developing plans, when partners and technical service providers are providing plans, things that we see as issues or just things to watch out for when you're developing those plans. And then at the end, I'll have a couple slides on becoming a technical service provider if anyone is not one and is interested. And then hopefully we'll have a little bit of time for some questions. So just a little bit about NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service. There's a few people in this room, at least, that are old enough to probably know us as our previous name, the Soil Conservation Service. But NRCS is an agency of the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, and our agency provides voluntary, non-regulatory services to farmers, forestry landowners, private landowners, tribal partners, and other organizations. And most of those services are in two different forms, technical assistance or financial assistance. And that assistance revolves around conservation practices, the conservation planning and recommendation of different practices to address natural resource concerns, the design of those practices, as well as the implementation. And one of those conservation practices is nutrient management, which is Conservation Practice Standard 590. And I always apologize when I'm doing a nutrient management training for NRCS employees and partners because I may use 590 nutrient management interchangeably, and I apologize for that. 590 is just my lingo for nutrient management, so bear with me. I'll try not to. So our nutrient management conservation practice standard 590, this is the definition. The management of the amount, source, method of application, and timing of plant nutrients and soil amendments. And hopefully that looks pretty darn familiar. It's right in line with the 4R principles of nutrient management. And when I get into the standard a little bit more, you'll see that that really is the foundation of this practice standard. So it's only appropriate that it's in the definition. All of our conservation practices have purposes. And these purposes really are in line with a farmer's objective of why they would do this practice, and why that practice would be selected as a conservation practice to address specific resource concerns. So these are the five purposes of nutrient management. First and foremost, it's about providing nutrients for crop production. That's why anyone does nutrient management. That's the basics of why it exists. One of our other purposes is the proper utilization of manure and other organic byproducts as a source. Maintaining or improving soil condition, and that's related to all three of the properties, physical, chemical, and biological. These last two purposes are the ones that I'll really be focusing on today. Water quality, making improvements and reducing pollution when it comes to surface and groundwater. And the last purpose, protecting air quality, And this is in ways of reducing odors, especially when we're applying manure products, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, as well as reducing the formation of particulates. So I said at the beginning when I talked about that definition, it's related to the four principles of nutrient management. And I'm not going to spend too much time on this because most of us, for CCAs and here for credits, we already know more than we could teach a class on this. But if you are not familiar with the four principles, I would encourage you to visit the website, nutrientstewardship.org. This website has a lot of really great training modules that are pretty basic or pretty good if you just need a brush up on your four R's of nutrient management. So our practice standard, a lot of it, the way it's laid out, it talks about each one of these R's. We talk about using the correct source, the rate, the timing, and the placement. And that's the general criteria and the basics. But we like to take it a step further. And we like to also consider nutrient management as a system. So it's not just about applying the nutrients. Sometimes we're going to need additional practices in that system to be able to meet those purposes, especially when it comes to water quality. And we like to design a system that's going to avoid, control, and trap. We're going to avoid nutrient loss, control runoff, and trap nutrients or sediment that may be leaving the field. And that can range in a lot of different practices. Sometimes we can address all of the resource concerns with those four R's, but then there's going to be other times where we're going to need other practices. There's no way we can maintain them. They're going to be leaching. They're going to be running off. And that's when these other practices are going to come into play. So that's part of our management and our practice standard is knowing when you need to have that. I like to call it an enhanced four R's. You're going above and beyond just those four R's and thinking about other ways that you can also address the nutrients that may be a potential for loss. I wouldn't be complete doing a nutrient management presentation without talking about strategies and technologies. So I wanted to put this slide up there because we encourage any products that can increase efficiency, be it slow-release fertilizers, the use of inhibitors, anything that can keep those nutrients in the crop zone, the root zone, so that the crops can use them and they won't move off-site. Also, technology. Technology is moving fast. There's a lot of great technology options out there. I've been to several sessions just yesterday and today listening about new technology, sensor technology, optical technology, a lot of things I'm not really sure I understand 100% how it works at this point. And also decision-making apps on your phone. There's a lot of great resources out there that you can learn about, and I believe one of the sessions later today is going to be talking about kind of a clearinghouse for reviewing some of these products and other tools that farmers can use to help you make those decisions. And one of the things I always say is we don't endorse any particular products. And when I talk to people in industry that have their latest and greatest product or new tool, I encourage them to work with the land-grant universities. I encourage them to work with the state water quality authorities, the fertilizer officials in those states, to talk to them, especially if there's a registration that's going to be needed or any other approval process. And also, I like to get samples, so I also encourage them to provide samples, especially if it's a new product. Give samples to some of the farmers, let them try them out in a few passes in their field or one of their smaller fields so that they can build that buy-in and appreciate the new products and technology that you have to offer. Who doesn't love a good sample? I also wanted to put a slide in here about adaptive management. And adaptive management is a great concept, and it really has a really good fit with nutrient management. And when you do adaptive management, it's really about developing a plan, testing an idea. I'm going to change my nitrogen rate, or I'm going to fine-tune my timing. And then you implement that plan, you evaluate that plan, the implementation, and then you make adjustments. So with nutrient management, this has a really great fit, and we've seen that used as far as corn farmers being able to make some management changes and then evaluating them, make little tweaks out on their farm. And one of the keys with adaptive management is also doing those on-farm trials, which is a great learning opportunity to bring other farmers in to hear about what you did, what worked, what didn't work. What didn't work is sometimes the hardest thing to get people to talk about, but that's those lessons learned that would be a great benefit to your farmers next door. So now I'm going to actually get into the basics of a nutrient management plan. The other information was kind of just setting us up for talking about what's in a nutrient management plan. And I often get asked, so what's the difference between what I do as a consultant or a CCA for my farmers and a nutrient management plan? Isn't that what it is? And in most cases, as I run through all of these components, you're going to see the answer is typically going to be yes. The only thing, I have an asterisk by the risk assessment. And as CCAs, we know about soil and water. We know where those nutrients have the potential to run off. So I think a lot of times we're doing those risk assessments in our heads as we're making recommendations, but we're probably just not doing formal risk assessments where we're running tools, or we may not be doing documentation to show that we made that risk assessment, but we're usually doing it anyways. And also setbacks, we're always observing setbacks, especially when we're doing manure management plans. So I'll go through each of these components in detail. One thing I like to say up front is everything that I'll go through as far as the plan is concerned is from our National Conservation Practice Standard. I have notes on several of these slides which will say, see state-specific 590 requirements. And that's because with our national practice standards, we set the minimum criteria. But states have the ability to require a higher level of conservation, or sometimes due to state laws or state regulations, they may actually require a higher level of conservation and have a stricter criteria. So if you work in multiple states or if you work in one state in particular, you really need to become familiar with their state-specific 590 requirements. So basically what I'll go through today is the minimum criteria. There may be one or two other components when you get to some of these items, and I'll try to highlight those out for you as far as which ones that you need to make sure you're looking at those sections. But and if you ever have trouble finding those state-specific standards, you can just let me know, and I probably should have put the link on here, but I can help you track them down. So first thing when we start off with the plan, we need maps. We need soils information. There's nothing that I appreciate more is having a little bit of information, especially if I can get it before the first time I'm going to a farm or when I do that second follow-up. You can tell a lot when you have a farm map, a field map, and you can definitely tell a lot when you start looking at those soils maps and you start looking at those soil properties. What's the soil texture out there? What's the inherent soil organic matter? Is there drainage problems? Is there flooding history? What's the depth to the water table? There's a lot of stuff you can know about a farm before you've ever even stepped foot on there, just by simply looking at the soils information and some of those maps. And one of the things when you look at the maps, you can also look for some of those sensitive areas when I get to the setbacks. You can identify some of those better on maps than you can even when you're out there because of the trees maybe hiding your site. So maps are very important. The next step and requirement is a nutrient budget. And for this, you'll need a lot of information. You're going to need the crops that are growing and the sequence of those crops. And then you're going to need those expected realistic yields that you're going to be using, your yield goals. And I stress the realistic part. That's the important thing. You don't want to use someone's top yield or their worst yield. And then you want to start looking at the N, P, and K requirements for those crops in order to get that production. Nutrient credits from prior year crops or cover crops. What's the nutrient removal of those crops? And then, of course, your current soil nutrient levels. Although after the last presentation, I'm not going to talk too much about soil sampling because he did a great job. One of the things about nutrient budgets is you need to make sure that they're by field and by crop. Some of you may have it easy, I would say, if you only have two or three crops that you mainly work with. But if you work somewhere like California or here in Arizona or Florida, or you work with some specialty crop growers, you may have a dozen or 20 or 30 different crops that you need to know about. And they're all going to have different crop nutrient requirements. They're going to have different uptake curves. So it can get quite challenging when you're doing budgets for some of those different cropping systems. And then you talk about growing some of those crops in 1 year, where you have three or four crops in 1 year, and your budget gets to be a very, very intensive project. One part is also you need to make sure you identify all of the sources and the nutrient values of those sources. And that goes to soil sampling, when you're using manures, or compost, biosolids, other products, knowing those nutrient values. And also, you're going to need to know those the moisture content when you're using manures as well. Legume credits. If you have crops, soybeans, there's a lot of generic credits that you give. If you're doing something like a cover crop and you want to give credit, that can be a little bit more tricky. You're going to need to know more information. What's the mix of that cover crop? What's actually in it? And what's going to be giving you some nutrients for future that you should be giving credit to? Not only what's in it, but when are you terminating it? One way to some of the tables, you can use the height of the cover crop at termination to estimate those nutrient values. If you know the growth stage, that can really help you refine how much credit you should give that cover crop when you're doing your nutrient budget. Synthetic fertilizers. Sometimes that's straightforward, but one of the ones that I think people forget about is the nitrogen in your MAP, your DAP products. There's sometimes things that we forget. We're applying it for one purpose, but there may be other nutrients in there as well that we need to capture. And of course, irrigation water, those people that are using irrigation, hopefully that's a given that you're including that irrigation water, that you're taking into account how much irrigation water you're typically applying, and accounting for that as well in your budget. So I only have two slides for soil sampling, and I'm glad because I would have hated to have a ton because he did a really good job earlier talking about this. And I think it's really important that we talk about soil sampling when it comes to nutrient management. This is one of the most useful tools that we have when it comes to making your nutrient budget and kind of predicting what's available in the soil. And there's five important factors, I think, when you're doing samples, and these are pretty in line with what Dr. Miller had in the last session. What depth you're taking a sample, what time of year, how many cores per composite sample you're taking, what's the amount and distribution of those samples over your field or your zone, and the frequency of sampling. Those are all really important things that you need to be thinking about, and they can vary. One place I'd point you if you're first starting out would be land-grant universities and their soils lab. There's a lot of great brochures and information depending on what crops are growing. It's really helpful to make sure that you are reading up on what the common practice is for your particular area. I'm glad my slide's not too out of touch with what Dr. Miller just talked about, the grid or zone sampling. And this is something I get questions about from our own field staff. And sometimes people will actually use these two terms interchangeably, and they're very different. They're both about creating boundaries where we can apply different application rates. But that's pretty much the limit of their similarities. And both of them have pros and cons. When I talk about grid, it's pretty much anything less than 2.5 acre grid quadrant or grid area that we're talking about, where zones can be larger. So right there, you can tell there's going to be an expense difference, how many samples you're taking every year. But sometimes you have a lot of great information to build those zones. You have good soils history, soils information. Maybe you've done past grid sampling, so you can use that to help you develop those zones. You have your yield maps. You have your aerial photos. Sometimes fields can just be laid out. You can just see them. Sometimes even on the aerial photo, you can see those areas just from the soil color difference. So I would not completely discredit the use of zones. We call them conservation management units and zones as far as planning. And I think there's a good fit for both of them. Doing the grid sampling less frequently to get a handle and maybe to help you set up those zones to begin with, and then maybe being able to do zone sampling on those regular routine soil sampling and not having to have that expense. But people will probably disagree with that, but everyone has an opinion on that. So it probably depends, like he said, the price of corn will determine how much sampling you're going to be doing. So in addition to routine soil sampling, you also have to look to additional sampling options. And this is one I think that hopefully is kind of gaining more and more traction, doing that in-season soil sampling, that pre-side-dress nitrate test to determine if you need to even apply more nitrogen, and if you do, how much, kind of being able to fine-tune throughout the season, giving those crops the nutrients that they need rather than putting them all out there at once. I'm a huge fan of giving the crops what they need when they need it, because that really helps us minimize the potential for loss. Manures, make sure you're doing really good manure sampling. Anytime those animals are, the numbers are changing, their management is changing, their feed is changing, the content of those manures can actually change due to some pretty small differences. So it's important to get a handle on what that nutrient content is, especially if it's not from your farm and you're getting nutrients from outside sources. It's important to have that information. Plant tissue testing is another option for looking at nutrients in your plants throughout the season. Irrigation water, already touched on that. The use of optical sensors, using chlorophyll meters, some of the sensors that you can look at the soil, it looks at the soil color, the greenness of the plants. There's a lot of great technology and tools that have been used for quite a while that can really be helpful as far as fine-tuning. And if I know there's some really advanced products out there and technology where they can actually use the sensor in the front of the tractor and adjust the application rate in the back, which is pretty impressive technology, I think. Setbacks. This is something that if you're doing new manure plans and CNMPs for animal operations, you're probably familiar with setbacks. And this is one where you would really need to look at the states, because those state-required setbacks will be state-specific typically. And these are going to be areas, any sensitive areas, any areas where you can't apply nutrients. And my examples here mainly have to do with water quality, not applying where the 100 foot from the ditch or the stream, watching out for wellheads, making sure you're not spreading in a grass waterway, which often can be a pretty direct conduit to a ditch or into a stream, sinkholes. But one of the other things when you're thinking about air quality, knowing where the nearest schools are, the nearest residences that aren't owned by the farmer. When you think about things like odors, dust, particulate matter, those things you need to take into account. And I think more and more in some areas, those are also having setbacks as well. So it's important to remember that. Timing. This is one that's in our conservation practice standard that I think everyone loves to hate. In our national practice standard, we state that nutrients must not be surface applied if losses are likely. And this pretty much limits the application or removes the application of manures on frozen or snow-covered soils or saturated soils. This is one, and I have down here some exceptions. You really need to look at the state's practice standard, because there are some states that have this limit. They have months during the course of the year that you cannot apply. But there's a lot of states, especially those that have winter, long winters, like Wisconsin, where they're going to have an emergency plan, you're going to have a possibility. And the key is with those exceptions, you have to make sure that those fields that will receive during those times of year have mitigation in place. They have in place conservation, the way that the land is formed, so that you're not going to have those losses and impacts to water quality, because those are the times of year where if you apply to them, you're pretty much, it's a given that you're going to have some losses. So we just really want to minimize that. Risk assessments. This is the part where a lot of you, I think, are doing it in your head when you're doing fertilizer recommendations and nutrient management plans, but maybe you're not doing it using our formal tools. And again, state-specific, our states have specific guidance, which will be in their practice standard as to which tools they use. And this is the one I think that we have some challenges with partners and technical service providers being able to get that training in a timely manner. Use of these tools isn't something that you're usually using on a regular basis. And so the training is definitely something that we'll need to do. When you talk about nitrogen leaching, there's the nitrogen leaching index, the nitrogen index. Phosphorus, every state has a phosphorus index tool. Again, another thing that people love to hate. And there's a lot of been a lot of great effort going into looking at these different phosphorus index tools, because right now they're state specific, and you could go to states side by side and run the exact same numbers in those tools and get different numbers. And I don't like that. I definitely don't like that. So there's been, like I said, there's been several different conservation innovation grants where we're looking at different regions. So I anticipate in the future that we will probably try our best to move to some type of regional approach to be able to make those tools a little bit more region specific, different only because of the challenges of those regions. I don't think I would go so far as to say we're going to have a national tool that everyone has to use, because I think there are region, climatic, soils management differences that do vary by region. So that's something to watch for in the future. But that's one tool that people would have to be trained on, is looking at phosphorus loss pathways, erosion, leaching, proximity to stream, the soil test phosphorus. It's definitely an important risk assessment. And then also soil erosion. We want to assess soil loss in relation to protecting water quality and soil quality. So we look at assessing loss from sheet and reel and wind erosion. And with this, we use T, the soil loss tolerance. And for any of the fields that we find soil loss is greater than T, that soil loss, it varies from 1 to 5, depending on the soil characteristics, that soil loss is above T, then you'll need to make sure that there's conservation in place so that you're not having a high amount of soil erosion. And the same thing goes for concentrated flow. If you have gully erosions in your field, if you have gully erosion or you have a classic gully out there, that needs to be addressed, because again, that's just another pathway for those nutrients to be moving off the farm. So my one picture there on the left is a beautiful grass waterway, some terraces, some no-till. There's a lot of different practices out there that a farmer can do to help address their soil erosion on the farm. Last but not least, record keeping. I am a huge keeper of records. I think that it's really important to know crop history, to know your crop management, your planting dates, your harvest dates, your yields, all of your sample results, being able to watch for those trends over time, being able to have those records of what you have been recommended and then what you applied, being able to look at those differences over time and make adjustments according to those records. And also weather data, which I don't think we have a trouble with that. I haven't met a farmer yet that doesn't have a lot of weather data, either in his head or on a spreadsheet, or he knows exactly where to go find it on the internet nowadays. With records keeping, we recommend that records be kept for at least 5 years. But for me, I would recommend people keep them as long as they have space, especially now that people can keep electronic records. So now I'm going to move on to what I call the things to watch. And the first thing I did when I was first asked to do this presentation is I called a couple of our states that I know do a lot of what we call conservation activity plans for nutrient management conservation activity plans, which means technical service providers and partners are developing nutrient management plans. They come into our office and they may be getting financial assistance to implement those plans, or they got financial assistance to do those plans. And I asked those states, okay, what are the deficiencies? When you get these plans, what's missing? What's the missing link? How can I help explain to certified crop advisors and partners what's missing and what they could do differently to make those plans be useful when they walk through the door? So if you do that plan for a farmer and that farmer brings it to us and they want to get financial assistance to implement that plan, what do they need to know? And I, basically from those two people I talked to who review a lot of this, they basically said the purpose of the nutrient management plan. And by that, I mean not the purpose of crop production, because that's what all of our nutrient management plans are based on, but the purpose beyond that. Is it for water quality? Is it for protecting air quality? Or none of the above? And for our environmental quality incentives program, the EQIP program, we need to be implementing conservation to address a natural resource, water quality, air quality, soil degradation. And so crop production, unfortunately, is not something that falls under those natural resources. And so this is one of the challenging parts, and this is where it gets to going beyond those four R's. You may be able to address water quality on some farms just by implementing the four R's, but sometimes you won't. And if you are, then it's important to make a little note on those plans as to why you're making that change in timing, why he's going to split applications, why you've changed your source that you're going to be using, and really noting what that farmer is going to be doing to in that nutrient management plan that is different, that's going to help address a resource concern. And this is just, again, just another step that maybe you're not thinking of documenting. So, and this just gets into that idea of an enhanced nutrient management plan, going beyond those four R's when you need to address those additional purposes. It may be as simple as a conservation crop rotation, where you have varying roots that are taking nutrients from different layers of the soil, incorporating a winter cover crop, using reduced tillage. If he had soil erosion out there, maybe you're going to reduce your tillage so he's going to have less soil erosion, less sediment going off the farm. There are going to be times where you need to put some buffers in. You may have maybe those setback areas, you can actually put in a 35-foot buffer at the edge of them, and that will be serving the purpose of both having that setback, but also providing that filter strip and that buffer area that can be vegetated. And if you really want bonus points, you plant it to a pollinator habitat, and it can really meet multiple purposes as well. Thinking about things like drainage water management, using that drainage water as recycling it and using it as irrigation water. That can be a great source of nitrogen in your plan. Thinking of that, thinking of constructed wetlands. One of the things I think that is a great practice is it's not that widely accepted is strip cropping with a perennial crop. If you have a market for hay, maybe having some strips out there that really break up the area and put them in some perennial vegetation where you can have those alternating strips out there. That makes a huge difference when you think about things like water quality and soil erosion. One of the other things that I see is I really want nutrient management plans to be useful. I don't like to see a nutrient management plan be put together, it's beautiful, it goes in a three-ring binder, and it gets set on the shelf. The happiest a farmer can make me is when I go to their farm and I sit down in their office and they or their pickup truck and they pull out a nutrient management plan that's in this ratty old three-ring binder that's fallen apart. They've got their soil test results in the clear sheet so they can look back at them. That makes my day. I don't know about you, but I want nutrient management plans to be useful for the farmers, because otherwise they're doing no one any good. So that's one of the things that I try to stress. We want to be practical, and we want them to be usable by the farmers. These are just going to be a few little notes that I have to myself about things to watch. Using realistic crop goals. Again, don't use the record yield in your county. Don't use the best year. Don't use the worst year. I don't think anyone ever uses the worst year. But we do have a tendency sometimes to over-exaggerate when we're setting our realistic yield goals or expected yield. Don't forget the four R's. I've talked a lot about additional practices, but looking at those four R's and fine-tuning those is sometimes a great way to make a huge impact on the farm. Tweaking that timing, adjusting the rate that you have, making it more site-specific to what the farmer's doing. That's the simplest way to really improve nutrient management on the farm. Over-application, it's just a common thing. I think anyone who's in agriculture knows that there's going to be some over-application going on. Everyone does it. We overeat. A little bit is good. A lot is better. It's the same idea. So this is one of the things we get questions about from our offices that are looking at plans. So when is it too over application? When is it too much? And like a good agronomist, I say, well, it depends. I mean, my typical range is it between 10 and 15%? Then they're good. But then you have to start asking those questions, well, what happened that year? When did they apply too much? Did they come in and do pre-sidedress nitrate test? And using those results is why they made that over-application, because they determined this was the result and this is what they needed to apply. I mean, that's where it comes back to being practical. People are not out there over-applying nutrients just because they have money to burn. Usually, there's hopefully a method to the madness. And so that's one of the things, you know, figuring out, not just automatically kicking it out and saying, this doesn't meet, it doesn't meet, we're not paying for your nutrient management plan. It's about being practical and understanding what's going on out there. Timing, I've talked about that a couple of times. Fall application versus splitting application, fall application, spring application. We all know all of that. Most of our budgets are going to be N, P, and K. Don't forget about those other nutrients. Depending on what crops you're using, you may have other nutrients that you want to include in your budget that are really important to that crop. So I don't think anyone ever forgets those, but sometimes we have a tendency to forget about them enough that a deficiency starts to hurt our yield. And sometimes with some of those nutrients, it's too late to correct the problem. So just something to make sure you're thinking about the other nutrients as well. Records keeping, I talked about that a lot already. Soil sampling frequency. As far as NRCS is concerned, we consider a current soil sample to be no older than 3 years. Depending on the local land-grant university's recommendations and the specific intervals, maybe some states even have requirements when it comes to waste management or manures, biosolids. There may be specific regulations that govern this frequency, but we like to say at least 3 years. I personally would like to see it even more frequently. That's just because those results should be a key component when you're developing a fertility plan, when you're looking to make adjustments to those plans, and also for monitoring changes over time. When you think about some things move slow, But sometimes you can look back over 5, 6, 7 years of records, and you could see maybe if you're applying chicken litter, you can slowly start to see that phosphorus going up. So at what point are you going to start doing some type of drawdown? Just watching for little things like that in your samples and watching them over time. Again, it goes back to records keeping, being able to look back and see over the past few times that you did samples what those results were. I stuck this slide in there. It's the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence slide, just to remind me to make sure and say if you work with people that have pastures, remind them to soil sample and stress to them how important it is. I think sometimes, and it's a very generalized statement, but there's a lot of people that have pastures out there that probably have not soil sampled probably in forever. Maybe their granddaddy did it at some point when soil sampling was new. But that's definitely, pastures are an area where soil sampling can really help you identify some problems before they become big problems, and help you with weeds, with your productivity on your pasture. So it's definitely a good thing to remind people of. Fields receiving animal manures, biosolids, make sure you watch for those heavy metals, again, phosphorus accumulation. A lot of times states will have specific laws and regulations on these that are going to force you to be watching those over time. Calibration, when it comes to equipment, when it comes to sensors, again, being practical, but I've seen a lot of companies on their fertility recommendations and their plans, they actually have a little side note that says, don't forget to calibrate. I mean, I like that because that's a good reminder. I think that there's some people like to think that that's common knowledge and everyone's doing it, but I think that a lot of times people are in a hurry and maybe they don't take time to really make sure that their equipment is calibrated. And when it comes to new technology, using those sensors, make sure that those are calibrated and working properly. And same goes for technology. If you're using and encouraging people to take on new technology, a good part of doing that is education. Making sure that you're educating them on how it works, why it works, and what the difference it can make. That can make a big difference in a person understanding why they may or may not want to adopt something. And I think that's been one of the challenges with some of the new technology is people don't really understand all the pros and cons and what it could really do for them. Additional requirements, if you're working with any operations, organic operations, there's a lot of different certification programs out there for sustainability, especially at the vineyards on there. When you think about food safety, there's a lot of things you need to be thinking about because nutrient management and what you're applying to the field, it plays a role in all of these. And so you need to make sure that what you're recommending is in line with the regulations that they have to follow. My last slide, the importance of following up. A nutrient management plan should be a living document. It should be always changing. Every time you change your crops, you change your sequence, you change your tillage, you incorporate winter cover crops, you should be adjusting that nutrient management plan. Even throughout the season, like I mentioned, if you go out and take your pre-sidedress nitrate tests and you need to make adjustments, you need to make at least a pen and ink change to your nutrient management plan so you know what you did that year. When site condition change, when you put in new drain tiles or a new irrigation system, manure has already touched on that. But it's just really important to make sure that those plans are regularly being reviewed, evaluated, and updated. So with that, I will say thank you. I actually have two additional slides, just really quick, about becoming an NRCS technical service provider. If you are interested, these are professionals like yourselves, individuals or businesses that provide technical services to producers, no different than what our field staff do, and a lot of times it's going to be an even more better service because you guys are experts at these particular categories. And one of those categories is nutrient management. We have the practice of nutrient management, and we also have what we call conservation activity plans. There is one specifically for nutrient management plans and one that's for CNMPs, which is a comprehensive nutrient management plan for animal operations. Some of those can get a little bit engineering specific, so a lot of times an agronomist and an engineer would work on those together. So if you're interested, search NRCS TechReg TSP. That's what I do when I need to get on that webpage. If you have a CCA certification or a CPAG, some of the other certifications, as well as the crop certifications through the National Alliance of Independent Crop Consultants, that's kind of a fast track as far as your knowledge, skills, and abilities to becoming a TSP. There's also some additional requirements as far as conservation planning and using, learning how to use those risk assessment tools. But a lot of it's in line with what I went through today. So each state has a technical service provider. It's their job to help you if you are interested in becoming a technical service provider. So contact them. The national website should have the link to who that person is. If not, track me down and I will make sure and point you in the right direction.